Hi, good evening. My name's John Grebar. I'm one of the interventional cardiologists here at Holland Hospital. I'm also with Spectrum Health. What I wanted to talk to you about tonight is really optimizing cardiovascular health. And my hopes is to really tailor this talk to your interests and your questions and your needs. So if you have any questions along the way, don't hesitate to interrupt, raise your hand. You know, feel free to ask questions. I'd like to make this interactive. So just to begin with, we'll go over some background and general information with regards to what is vascular health. And it relates to the circulatory system. The circulatory system really has three components: the arterial circulation, the venous circulation, and then the lymphatic circulation. And it works like a plumbing system, where blood circulates through the arterial circulation into the tissue, which is basically like a sponge. And then the blood that's absorbed into the tissue, the oxygen is taken out of it, and that blood then travels back through the lymphatic system and enters back into the circulatory system through a complex lymphatic network. Is there a pointer on here? There we go. So here you could see the blood flowing through the arteries out into the tiny, tiny blood vessels, which we call capillaries, which are in all of our tissues, the muscle, the heart, the liver, the kidneys. Oxygen-rich blood's taken out into the tissue, and then it drains back out through the lymphatics, which then drains into the venous system and back into the heart. So the blood that isn't absorbed by the tissues or the organs is then returned through the venous circulation and completes the plumbing circuit, returning blood into the heart, where it is then recirculated into the lungs to pick up oxygen, and then gets pumped back out to the body through the left side of the heart. So arteries versus veins, there's a number of structural differences that really underscore how they function. The arteries are under high pressure, so they have a thick elastic muscular wall, and that's to support pulsatile blood flow throughout the circulation. The venous circulation is low pressure. It's built to contain a lot of blood volume. It has a thin fibrous wall, which is elastic. And to facilitate blood return, it's also dependent on having valves, particularly in the legs. For the purpose of tonight's talk, we're really going to focus on the arteries and diseases of the arterial circulation, because that's really ultimately what governs cardiovascular health. And when we think about conditions of the arteries, there's hundreds of them. But it really boils down to atherosclerosis, 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 atherosclerosis. It's really the top 99. There's a long list of other conditions of the arteries that we won't significantly go over this evening. So looking at atherosclerosis, what is atherosclerosis? Just simply put, it's hardening of the arteries, typically due to the plaque formation in artery walls, and it can happen anywhere. We've all heard of heart disease. That really typically refers to atherosclerosis of the heart arteries. But this disease process is really a systemic syndrome that occurs throughout the body. So it's a systemic syndrome. When we talk about heart disease, that's CAD, or coronary artery disease. CVD is cerebrovascular disease. That's vascular disease affecting the arteries to the brain and the brain. And then peripheral arterial disease refers to atherosclerosis in other organ systems, such as other arteries, such as the circulation of the legs, or the circulation of the bowel, the circulation of the kidneys, which would be the renal arteries. And there's a large overlap. When patients have atherosclerosis in one vascular territory, the heart or in the brain, it's commonly found elsewhere. And that's what this reflects here, is it's really an overlap syndrome. And this refers to symptomatic vascular disease. So these are patients with symptomatic peripheral vascular disease and symptomatic coronary artery disease. The harder we look, the more we can find. and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So what is atherosclerosis? It's a chronic inflammatory syndrome that begins at a very young age. It's the end result of multiple medical conditions. It's not the end result of any one condition in particular. And it affects arterial blood vessels, and it's the end result of an inflammatory response of our body, typically through white blood cells, to the presence of cholesterol or lipids. And the accumulation of these inflammatory cells in response to the presence of cholesterol is called fatty streaks. So the fatty streaks progress into what's referred to as a plaque, and or another term for this is atheroma, and this is from the Greek word athera, or a lump of gruel, and it's really a nodular accumulation of yellowish material, and it's the that plaque contains cholesterol, but it contains much more than cholesterol. It also contains all the inflammatory cells in the body trying to mount a response against it. And as the body mounts this inflammatory response, calcification will start to develop around the margins of the cholesterol in the plaque. So atherosclerosis, as I mentioned, this is a normal artery up here. The artery wall has multiple layers to it. This is a nice healthy three-layered wall with what's referred to as the intima, the inner layer, the media, which is the muscular middle layer, and then the adventitia, which is more of a structural fibrous outer layer. So at an early age, we start to develop fatty streak, or the deposit of cholesterol and fats on the inner lining of our blood vessels, on that intima. And over the next 10 to 20 years, that process is thought to be reversible. And the body's working on mounting an inflammatory response. But as inflammation within the intima, and particularly the endothelium, which is the inner lining of the blood vessel, continues, some of that cholesterol starts to invade into that inner layer called the intima. And it creates a tremendous inflammatory response with our infection-fighting cells. And over the next 20 to 40 years, the inflammatory response will lead to an accumulation of cholesterol, an accumulation of these infection-fighting cells, and eventually it'll start to organize into what's very similar to scar tissue. It'll become tough, somewhat fibrous. And then over 20 to 40 years, it can become calcified. So just some striking statistics about atherosclerosis. We're all at risk for it. In fact, one of the largest risk factors for developing atherosclerosis is unfortunately aging. We're going to talk about some risk calculators later on in the presentation. And kind of hidden in those risk calculators, the first thing you put in is your age. It seems kind of minor. It's actually the strongest predictor of the development of atherosclerosis. Remarkably, only 1 in 5 of these survey respondents actually thought they were at risk for atherosclerosis. And when they asked these people, what they thought the risk factors for atherosclerosis were, only 1 in 5 could identify all 6 risk factors. But interestingly, when they asked them, they didn't ask them about age. They asked them about everything else we think of. Age, hypertension, hypertension, which is high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking. But age was not one of the risk factors that they even asked about. So I think that's kind of interesting. So bad news, as I said, aging, it's a setup for atherosclerosis. We're all, unfortunately, at risk for it. And we're all at risk for it because there's just fundamental changes that, unfortunately, occur as we get older. We get asked all of the time by patients why it seems as though their cholesterol levels are rising. Well, there's metabolic changes that occur, and with aging, the bad cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, goes up with age. Muscle mass decreases every day, especially once we hit 40 or 50, our muscle mass starts to go. That means we need to exercise just to maintain the muscle that we had yesterday. Cardiac performance decreases due to a number of factors. With aging, there's heart rate slowing. The peak heart rate that we can achieve becomes lower due to changes in the electrical system. There's structural cardiac changes, and a result of all these changes, our level of fitness unfortunately declines as we get older. We also lose the elasticity in our arteries. And with this, blood pressure slowly increases as we age. It's very controversial whether aging actually causes hypertension or high blood pressure. That's not entirely clear whether hypertension is an end result of aging. It's a very difficult issue to sort out, but there are mild increases in blood pressure that do occur. So even when we think about healthy hearts, what's a healthy heart? Well, when we think about organ donors, they're supposed to have the most pristine organs available. They come typically from young patients. Well, when these hearts have been looked at with a very detailed, the heart arteries have been looked at in a very detailed way by putting an ultrasound into the inside of the artery, the artery should look nice and smooth. Like this one right here. This is the artery down the front of the heart, the left anterior descending. This is that little rim that kind of looks like a crescent moon. That's the intima, and it's very minimally thickened there. That's very minimal atheroma. That's what we all kind of hope to see as we get older, just minimal evidence of atherosclerosis. This is an ultra-sensitive way to look for atherosclerosis. But this came from a healthy donor heart. What they found in the other arteries is, look at this. You kind of see this. This is the inside of the blood vessel. Half of it's kind of obliterated here. This is all plaque in what was deemed a healthy donor heart. And that's because atherosclerosis is very common. And the harder we look for it, the more we can find. It doesn't mean that this is of any significance to the patient at this point. Either the unfortunate individual who passed or the patient receiving the donor heart. But there's evidence of the disease process or the syndrome, atherosclerosis. And what this looks at is, it all depends on what threshold we're using for defining atherosclerosis. And these are two different thresholds. This is looking at the thickness of that inner layer, the intima. Some of you may have heard of carotid intimal thickness. It's the same thing. It's thickening of the intima due to atherosclerosis. This is intimal thickness in a coronary artery. The higher the threshold, then we're going to, have a less, the prevalence won't be as high because we have a higher cutoff for detecting it. But as we look at arteries in normal, healthy hearts, by age 50, using this ultra-sensitive test, we can detect atherosclerosis in about 90% of 50-year-olds. It's tremendously common, and it increases as we age. So I know this is all kind of depressing, and it's not all depressing news. We'll talk about that in a bit. So cardiovascular health, there's three components to it: heart disease, peripheral arterial disease, and cerebral vascular disease. Cardiovascular disease, number one, is the leading cause of death. 1 in 4 U.S. deaths is attributed to heart disease. A lot of statistics here. The important thing to take home is that this is very common, and it's preventable, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. Heart disease accounts, this says 1 in 5 deaths, 1 heart attack every 30 seconds, 1 death from a heart attack every minute. 1 in 3 die before reaching the hospital. 85% reduction in heart disease mortality. The number of patients dying from heart disease has declined dramatically. And I have a slide on this also later on. A lot of this since 1980 to 2000, and now into now almost 2020, mortality, deaths from heart disease continues to decline. largely related to medical therapy, not what we're doing with procedures. You hear about stents, not what we're doing with surgery. It's really medical therapy. So heart disease, this is atherosclerosis in heart arteries. There's two issues that arise from atherosclerosis in heart arteries. There's the formation of a plaque, which progresses. The cholesterol builds up over time, leads to a critical narrowing. With this critical narrowing, the blood supply to the heart becomes insufficient. The heart wants blood and oxygen. It's a muscle to pump. And when the demands for that increase with exercise, patients develop angina, or heart-related chest pain due to the insufficiency of oxygen delivery from this narrowing. This is a plumbing problem, and this can be treated very effectively with medicines. If angina becomes severe or significant or responds inadequately to medicines, we can treat this with different types of procedures to improve flow. One option would be a stent. There are other surgical options such as bypass. This is typically does not cause a heart attack. A heart attack occurs when there's a pre-existing plaque, and due to inflammation of that inner layer, the intima, the plaque becomes unstable, and there's different ways this plaque can become unstable. Two most common types are plaque rupture, where it literally opens up to the blood. The cholesterol is very irritating to the blood, and the clotting factors in the blood, the platelets stick to that cholesterol, form a clot, and close the artery. There's also what's called plaque erosion, where tiny little holes open up on that thin outer layer covering the plaque. And that's what's depicted in this slide, these vulnerable plaques that lead to heart attacks. There's a number of different mechanisms where patients can develop symptoms from heart disease. These three right here, rupture, erosion, and calcification, can all lead to clots forming inside the blood vessel and leading to the artery closing. So in this case, you have cholesterol here. There's a thin layer of intima over that, that healthy endothelium that we hope for. But due to inflammation, due to a variety of factors, smoking, diabetes, and even stress is thought to play a role, this inner lining can become irritated and either rupture or erode. And then the blood, the red here, these are platelets, which are the clotting factors, stick to the cholesterol and create what's called a thrombus and then close the artery. Here, this is a plaque that's been around for a while. It's got calcification. The calcification, as if it protrudes out into the blood vessel, is also very irritating. It can cause platelet aggregation, and also a clot can form and lead to a heart attack. And then finally over here, this is the first mechanism that we talked about, stenosis, where the plaque has grown significantly, narrowed the inner lumen of the blood vessel, and has restricted blood flow significantly. So those are the various mechanisms by which atherosclerosis can become lead to symptoms. So very commonly, patients come in with heart attacks and we're asked, how severe was the blockage? Well, with most heart attacks, it's 100% blockage. There was a clot there, it closed off the artery, patients develop chest pain. But it's, like I said, it's related to the clot, not the blockage per se. And when we look at, this is a very complicated slide, I want you to focus over here in these three bars right here. When we look at the underlying blockage that led to the heart attack in these patients, 68% of the patients had blockages of less than 50%. 18% had what we consider moderate blockages of 50 to 70%. And only 14 had what are classified as severe blockages, more than 70%. And this is a little bit a matter of statistics, because like I said, this is a systemic syndrome that occurs throughout the body. And most blockages are in the mild to moderate range. We have very few severe blockages. So just statistically more likely to develop irritation of that atherosclerotic plaque in a mild or moderately blocked segment of the artery. So second component of cardiovascular health, peripheral arterial disease. This is atherosclerosis, build up of plaque in other organ systems other than the heart. In the heart, we talked about that most commonly patients develop symptoms from the formation of a clot or thrombosis. With peripheral arterial disease, symptoms typically occur from the stenosis, the narrowing or the plumbing problem, and the insufficiency of blood flow to that organ tissue, whether it's the muscles in the legs, which is lower extremity peripheral arterial disease, the arteries to the bowel. Patients can develop symptoms when they eat, discomfort after they eat. The bowel wants more blood flow. There's a severe narrowing. It can't deliver more blood flow, and discomfort can occur. Blockages are in the arteries to the kidneys. There's a number of phenomena that can occur, but the mechanism's the same. It's related to poor blood flow as a result of the stenosis, not a clot forming. And peripheral arterial disease is common. The harder we look for it, the more we find. But by 65, not 65%. 1 in 10 to 1 in 5 patients will have evidence of symptomatic peripheral arterial disease. So I just went over this a little bit. It really depends on the organ system where you find atherosclerosis. The symptoms can be variable. So, comparing heart disease to peripheral arterial disease, the extent of atherosclerosis somebody has matters. And this is also, another complicated slide, but this is looking at how long patients survive if they have one form of atherosclerosis. Down here on this axis is time in years. So if we look at patients with just coronary artery disease, this top red line, they have the best prognosis. At 10 years, about 60-70% of them are alive. If a patient has carotid artery disease, this is symptomatic carotid artery disease. These are patients who have had carotid endarterectomies. The prognosis is worse. And if a patient has had a triple A, which is a form of peripheral vascular disease, their prognosis is even worse. And why is this? That's because by the time someone develops a triple A or carotid artery disease, these patients are at high risk for having diffuse atherosclerosis or high burdens of atherosclerosis. And it's one way to look at the extent and the severity of this systemic syndrome. Typically, in the heart, I guess you could consider it a milder or less extensive version. So this is another way to look at the same issue. This is, again, looking at survival versus time. This is out to 50 months. Patients who have symptomatic peripheral vascular disease have a similar prognosis to patients with cancer. And that's not because they have peripheral vascular disease, but because they have extensive atherosclerosis. So the final component, cerebral vascular disease. Cerebral vascular disease occurs from basically three different mechanisms. The first would be a thrombotic stroke. So this would be the formation of a blood clot somewhere in the circulation, whether it comes from the heart, the aorta, the carotid arteries, or the clot originates in the brain. It can travel and close off one of the arteries to the brain. If it travels, it's considered an embolic stroke. If the clot originates in one of the blood vessels in the brain, it's considered a thrombotic stroke. The other mechanism of stroke is related to bleeding in the brain. This is related to a weakening in the blood vessel wall, typically related to an aneurysm. And this is referred to as cerebral hemorrhage. aneurysms anywhere in the body are outpouchings or weakening of the blood vessel wall, and they can be genetic or they can be the end result of atherosclerosis. So 9 of 10 strokes are related to conditions or factors that contribute to atherosclerosis. So it's a lot of kind of depressing news, but this is a preventable health condition. We hear about plane crashes, unfortunately, all too common. They're all over the news. But every day, 2,000 Americans pass away from heart attacks and strokes. Economic burden, that's $1.2 billion per day. So as I mentioned, there's two issues with atherosclerosis that drive symptoms. Stenosis, the narrowing of the artery, the plumbing problem, as well as thrombosis, which is the formation of a clot, which may also embolize and travel. So the focus on prevention is addressing the driving factors, not reversing the syndrome of atherosclerosis, which is really the end result of this diffuse inflammatory process. And there's a lot of opportunity for improvement. This is the United States, obviously. These are heart disease death rates. The areas that have the darkest red have the highest death rates. As you can see, this is really the hotbed for heart disease through the lower Midwest here. Why is this the case? It's probably a combination of factors. From poorly controlled risk factors as well as access to care. And it really reflects there's a lot of room for improvement because we're not all that different. So as I mentioned, to start with, prevention, a lot of different strategies, and we'll go over these. But it's important to know your risk to figure out how you should target preventative strategies. And hidden in this is the importance of age as we get older. Age is one of the most important risk factors for development of atherosclerosis. This is from the ACC risk calculator. This is what I commonly use. There's probably 5 or 10 of these. If you Google cardiac risk calculator, they're easy to find online. I'd encourage you to look up your laboratory values, check your blood pressure, and you can calculate your own risk. Very easy to do. I just plugged in some generic numbers here for an average 60-year-old, which we may see in a cardiovascular practice. 60 years old, total cholesterol 230, HDL 40, which is fairly typical, maybe a little bit on the high side. HDL is a good cholesterol. What's hidden in this is the LDL cholesterol, which is the total cholesterol is a combination of your HDL cholesterol, which is good, your LDL cholesterol, which is bad, and your triglycerides. So what's hidden in this is that the LDL is not explicitly entered. Systolic blood pressure is 150, so they're hypertensive. The blood pressure is not treated. They're a smoker and they're non-diabetic. Their 10-year risk of having a cardiovascular event, heart attack or stroke, is 23% with a lifetime risk of 50. So what would we do with this patient? Well, anything over 7.5 and certainly over 10% for a 10-year risk is calculated is considered high risk. So how do we think about this? What do we need to address? Well, right off the bat, they were hypertensive. We know we need to address that. I wish I could figure out this aging issue. This would be a gold mine. Family history, there's not much we can do about. They're not diabetic. These are all the risk factors across here. Weight, obesity, certainly an important risk factor in controlling obesity and weight is very critical because it addresses multiple other risk factors for cardiovascular disease. With weight loss, blood pressure improves, endothelial health or the health of the blood vessel improves, cholesterol improves. So by exercising and losing weight, you're really addressing multiple risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Alcohol and tobacco use, and then salt and sugar in the diet. So these are the ways we really look at prevention. So, as I mentioned, exercise, what is exercise? Really important to think about what we're doing here. It's more than just being active. It's really targeting a heart rate of 60 to 75% at least of your age predicted maximal heart rate. Does anyone know how to calculate that? How would you calculate? 220 minus your age. Perfect. Yep. So that's 100% of your max. So if you want to target 60 to 75% of that, 220 minus your age, say you're 60, is 160. And then minus 40% of 160, or 3/4 of 160, you're in the 120 range there. And you can ballpark this. It doesn't need to be exact. And when you exercise, you want to achieve this heart rate for 30 minutes, ideally 3, if not up to 5 times a week. For some patients, it's going to be a brisk walk. For some, it's going to take a lot more than that. One way to increase the heart rate with walking is to walk on a grade. That will quickly raise your heart rate. Weight loss, 10 to 15% has tremendous metabolic benefits to the body, and that's been best shown in diabetics, but even in non-diabetics, can significantly alter cholesterol profiles, improve blood pressure. Tremendous benefits to weight loss. It really does target multiple risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And then what about diet? Diets, and we're going to talk more about this in a little bit. A lot of people are interested in diet. There's like a gazillion diets out there on the internet. I'm not a big fan of diets per se. What I would encourage you patients to follow are healthy lifestyles, lifestyle changes. And the lifestyle change or the diet that really has been shown to benefit cardiovascular health the most is the Mediterranean diet. Other ways to modify your risk for heart disease are to think about taking an aspirin a day and a statin. And these are really tailored approaches based on the risk you an individual has for heart disease. So should I take an aspirin? This is a really tough question to answer. Clearly, for secondary prevention, what secondary prevention means is someone who's had a cardiovascular event, a stroke, a heart attack, some type of acute coronary syndrome, they have symptomatic peripheral arterial disease, they've had blockages in an organ system or blockages in their legs that have caused symptoms. There's no question that all these patients should be on an aspirin. What this shows, this is a very old study, but it shows that these groups of patients, patients who have had an MI stroke, mini stroke, coronary artery disease, peripheral arterial disease, they put lots of data together and did some very sophisticated statistics and calculated what are called odds ratio. And the bottom line is if you're to the left of this line, there's a benefit to aspirin, and if you're to the right, there's no benefit. And as you can see here, all these groups clearly benefited toward taking aspirin. So these are patients who have had symptomatic vascular disease. But what about people who haven't had an event yet? This is a complicated question. It's very controversial. There's just a study published on this that maybe showed that there's no benefit to taking aspirin. Other studies have shown benefit. I think it really depends on somebody's risk. And that's why I really encourage you to calculate your risk, go in, sit down with your doctor, and really go over the details and discuss the ways you can reduce your cardiovascular risk. So low-risk patients, these would be young, healthy people who don't have high blood pressure, not diabetic, don't smoke, definitely don't benefit from aspirin therapy. Intermediate risk, one way to look at that's with the risk calculator. This can be anywhere from 0 to 7.5%, probably a few percent to 7.5%. Very debatable. some things that don't go into these risk calculators that we do sit down and talk to our patients about are factors like family history. We know family history definitely plays a role in someone's risk for having a cardiovascular event. That's not captured in any calculator. It's a very difficult issue to study. It's a very difficult issue to put into a risk assessment algorithm. Diabetics are generally considered to be higher risk patients. The answer is generally yes, although some recent studies have also brought this into question. And then women, especially younger women, the answer is generally no. Again, this is primary prevention, so these are people or patients who have never had a symptomatic or have had symptoms from atherosclerosis. Yes? That's a great question. So why not take it, right? Well, the risk with aspirin is developing bleeding. And the most common risk with aspirin is stomach ulcers. But with any blood thinner, there's a risk of bleeding. So that's what we weigh that against. Yes? Yeah, that's a great question too, and that's because that's been looked at in multiple trials, and generally a baby aspirin is as effective as a full aspirin. The full aspirin increases the risk for stomach ulcers. So no added benefit, increased risk of ulcers. So in most scenarios, aspirin 81 milligrams or a baby aspirin is adequate. But that's something you should really discuss with your doctor. Yes? PFO. That's a whole different issue. So PFO is what's called a patent foramen ovale, and we're going to go the whole way back so I have a picture here. So PFO is what's short for patent foramen ovale. This is a communication between the top two chambers of the heart. This is the right atrium. This is the left atrium. There's usually a thin membrane between the two that separate the venous circulation from the arterial circulation. That membrane typically fuses shortly after birth. In about one in five patients, that membrane does not fully fuse. And there can be a communication between the venous circulation and the arterial circulation. And why that becomes important is because in very rare circumstances, clots can form in this venous circulation. And when they do form and travel, they typically would travel up through the right atrium here into the right ventricle, get pumped out into the lungs, and these tiny little clots would be absorbed by the lungs, typically without consequence, especially if they're small, and not cause any symptoms. But in rare circumstances where this membrane doesn't fuse and a clot forms, those tiny little clots can bypass the lungs. And when they get in the arterial circulation, they can travel anywhere. And when they do travel, the most problematic area they could land is in the brain and cause a stroke or mini stroke. And I think your question relates to whether taking aspirin for that, what dose of aspirin should be taken. I don't think there's great data on that, whether 81 is any better than 320 full aspirin or 325 milligram for preventing stroke. I just don't think the evidence is as robust as what we have for heart disease. But the safety data would argue that the risk of an ulcer would be higher. We are now making those are very complicated decisions that we make in conjunction with a vascular team. that's really a kind of an overlap where we see these patients with neurologists and really use their assistance to determine the best treatment for these patients. There's some increasing data that closing these PFOs can help reduce stroke. Certainly taking an antiplatelet like aspirin would also be indicated. But that's something we discuss in conjunction with neurology. So getting back to prevention, so exercise, what counts? Things we commonly hear, I don't exercise, but I'm active, I'm busy, I take care of my grandchildren, I'm doing stuff all the time, I'm cutting down trees, I'm chopping wood. Some of those things count, some of those things don't count, some of them count for certain patients, some of them probably aren't adequate for other patients. So it really gets back to what we just discussed, and I put this on multiple slides for a reason. 60 to 75% of the your age predicted maximal heart rate for 30 minutes, 3 to 5 times a week.
Is there a danger of spending time above the 75%?
A danger? No, I think it'd be something you'd want to talk to your doctor about and work up to. Certainly, as an initial approach, I think there would be some risk. It really is an individualized question that's, I guess, a little difficult to answer. But this is generally where we recommend starting out and then slowly building up to more vigorous activity. Yes?
Does doing the recommended things, improving your diet and exercising and the like, does that reduce the buildup in the veins or arteries, or does it just prevent more bad stuff from occurring?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're certainly reducing your risk of, you're improving the health of your blood vessels, reducing your risk of having one of these events. Whether it cures the blockage, reverses it, not substantially. There's some suggestion with very sensitive assessments that very aggressive cholesterol lowering with medications like statins and very aggressive lifestyle changes can reverse plaque formation or the buildup of cholesterol in the arteries. But I wouldn't say it's dramatic or significant to where you're completely reversing the disease process. What you do is improve the health of your blood vessels and the health of the tissues they support and really create new channels and efficiencies for blood flow and function. So exercise, a lot of benefits here. Reduction in body weight, but it really targets the risk factors for cardiovascular disease, reduces blood pressure, reduces bad cholesterol, LDL cholesterol and total cholesterol, increases good cholesterol, which is the HDL cholesterol, increases insulin sensitivity. Why this is important is it helps ward off diabetes or improve sugar or glucose control if you are diabetic. And it's been shown you'll live longer. So diets, I mentioned this a little bit. I don't like the term diet here, but it's the diet. Look at this as the Mediterranean lifestyle, and this is really a lifestyle that's rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, nuts, and seeds. Olive oil is very prevalent in this lifestyle change, and low to moderate wine consumption, 1 to 2 glasses of red wine a day, and low to moderate amounts of fish, poultry, and dairy products, little red meat. So lifestyle changes, as I mentioned, the Mediterranean diet's really got the most data to support this change. This was a European study with 10 years of follow-up, which is pretty remarkable, and it looked at 4 simple factors. People who adopted a Mediterranean diet were physically active, who consumed moderate alcohol and didn't smoke. Follow up over 10 years. This is their healthy lifestyle factor score. It's really simple. People who did zero to one of these had the worst prognosis. Really simple things. At 10 years, about 50% of them were alive. The patients who adopted all four, nearly 80%. A dramatic improvement in cardiovascular mortality, 65% with four simple things. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so that's a great question. I don't personally encourage people to consume alcohol if they don't. If they do drink alcohol, I encourage red wine 1 to 2 glasses a day. The exact mechanism by which it works is not well understood. Some components of the red wine are thought to be helpful in reducing inflammation. It does seem to be an effect that's specific to wine and red wine at that. And tonight we're talking about cardiovascular health, but you know, alcohol use is a complicated issue, and it has other health effects. It may improve cardiovascular health, but it can lead to other health issues. So it's not something we necessarily encourage if you don't consume alcohol. And certainly that's something to consider if somebody's on multiple medications or interactions. So I referred to this earlier. I don't like taking my medications. My cholesterol is high. Is this really going to help me? Well, it's really difficult to generalize that to everybody, but this is pretty striking. This is from the 1900s to about 1960. This is total cardiovascular mortality, very high mortality, and we've had a dramatic decrease since the 1960s in all diseases of the heart, coronary heart disease, and stroke. So something's having a dramatic effect. And I think it's a combination of all the therapies that we offer, from lifestyle changes to modern-day medicines. And why do medicines work? Because they target multiple mechanisms that lead to the formation of atherosclerosis. So these are four common medications that we use to treat heart disease: ACE inhibitors, aspirin, the statins. I think everyone's heard of statins. And what do they do? Well, ACE inhibitors, these medications reduce blood vessel constriction. Aspirin obviously has decreases platelet aggregation, so it decreases someone's risk for forming clots. Statins and ACE inhibitors reduce smooth muscle cell migration and growth. Why this is important is because if you remember from one of those very early slides I showed you, that during that inflammatory process where all those infection fighting cells are coming in, there's actually migration of smooth muscle cells from that middle layer, the media, into that inner layer of the blood vessel wall, and it changes the structure and composition of the wall and leads it to weaken and lose elasticity. Statins and ACE inhibitors actually target that mechanism, so it's changing the health of the blood vessel. And statins also decrease cholesterol or lipid deposition in the blood vessel wall. Other things that affect this inner lining that's so critical to blood vessel health: high cholesterol, the more you have, the worse it is. High blood pressure, diabetes, and smoking. So should I take fish oil? This is also a very, very complicated question. In general, we don't encourage fish oil consumption anymore. 5 years ago, we did. The main risk, or the main reason this is really twofold. One, it has not been shown to clearly reduce somebody's risk of a stroke or heart attack. And it may come at the risk in men of increasing prostate cancer, and that's high-grade prostate cancer. Why fish oil took off originally is because populations that seem to have the lowest risk of heart disease consume diets that contain greater than 60% saturated fat. These are the Eskimos. And they were consuming fats from fish. There are some reasons you should take fish oil. Certainly for triglycerides, it's a therapy that's always in the discussion. And it's always a matter of weighing the risks and benefits to these approaches. So salt, this has been in the news recently. Has anyone seen the news on salt? There was a recent study that came out that showed that maybe low salt isn't as good as we thought it was. This isn't necessarily applicable to everybody, but it seems as though the body does need some amount of salt every day, and it looks like the relationships in what we call a J-shaped curve, where if you have very low salt consumption, your risk of having some type of adverse outcomes high. Moderation seems to be good, and then when you swing to high salt, there's clearly risk with that. So like most things, in moderation, salt appears to be good, but that also really would depend on your overall health. So some take home points. Cardiovascular disease, number one cause of death, unfortunately. The end result of multiple health conditions. It's a systemic syndrome. Oh, we jumped right through this. Smoking, it's really any tobacco consumption, vaping, it's nicotine and all the inflammatory components, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. There's also the metabolic changes that I left off here from what we inherit from our family. There's certainly a strong genetic component to cardiovascular disease. Fortunately, it's a preventable condition and prevention is key. I encourage everyone to invest in their health, understand your risk, use the risk calculators, go to your doctor, and commit to optimizing these risk factors with a plan. And think about the use of aspirin and a statin to reduce cardiovascular risk. So, just a little cartoon here. What fits in your busy schedule better? Exercising 1 hour a day or being dead 24 hours a day? Any questions? Oh, I got a couple more slides here. We had some questions come in. I received a question about diets. So as I mentioned, I'm not a big fan of diets. There's the low carb diet and the keto diet, and there's like a gazillion Atkins diet. There's a gazillion diets out there. People don't stay on diets long term. They're good for quick and non-sustained weight loss, but they don't really alter cardiovascular health. What alters cardiovascular risk and improves health are lifestyle changes. So the question related to this low-carb diet, I would encourage not quick diets, but changes in lifestyle, and focusing on healthy fat intake. So this is a great resource, health.gov guidelines. There's a nice informational article there on diet, but the issue is complicated, and the question revolved around how many eggs were safe with a low-carb diet. So the background on this is low-carb diet is going to be high in fats, and there's really three types of fats: unsaturated, saturated, and trans fats. Trans fats, no one should really be trying to consume any trans fats. These are fried food. Icing is high in trans fats, unfortunately. Margarine, 0%. That's the recommendation. Don't consume trans fats. Saturated fats, 5 to 10% of your daily caloric intake. So about 200 calories based on a 2,000 calorie a day diet should come from saturated fats. This comes out to about 22 grams. Unsaturated fats, there's no upper limit. What's not spelled out up here is, what's this look like? Anybody? Mediterranean diet. So this, there's no upper limit on this. These are felt to be safe fats. So to answer the question, eggs, they're composed of unsaturated and saturated fats in total, have about 5 grams. So there's not an easy answer for this. It would really depend on what the other intake of fats was while on this low-carb diet. Other question related to low blood pressure, what's too low? Yes? Yeah, it's... What's that? Yeah, so some whole milk is okay. It really depends on your dietary, the overall dietary composition. So someone just asked this week, we work, in the procedure unit, was asking the nurses, what do the cardiologists eat? Everyone wants to know. So I'll admit, I don't eat the best, but I do try to make long-term, small lifestyle changes that are sustainable. So there are indiscretions along the way, but as I mentioned, I really think it's the long-term changes. So what we do and started to do years ago was work in a Mediterranean meal once a week and then twice a week and then healthy meals a few times a week. So that's kind of our approach, our family's approach. And I think it's a more sustainable change than dramatic dietary changes. And some patients and some people can make these dramatic changes and sustain them, and that's great, and it's remarkable, and I applaud that. But I think as a general approach for most, it's really figuring out what works for you. And I would encourage small daily, small weekly, or even if it's small monthly changes. So low blood pressure, what's too low? The definition of low blood pressure, what we call hypotension, is 90 over 60. That's not an absolute. What we consider low blood pressure is symptomatic. A blood pressure which is on the low side, which is symptomatic. So that's typically lightheadedness. It can sometimes be fatigue. Now, certainly passing out would be the extreme of that. That's certainly too low. Low blood pressure could be good. It reduces cardiac work. The heart is a pump. And it's a muscle, and it's squeezing against that blood pressure. The lower the resistance or the blood pressure that it sees, the less energy it uses, the less work is involved. So I just wanted to thank the hospital and the cath lab that I work with. These are some members of our cath lab, except one. I'm not going to point them out. If you would need our services, the hospital has invested in a tremendous facility down the hall here where we offer a variety of heart procedures, and we have a tremendous staff that really makes this a great place to receive cardiovascular care. So thanks to Holland Hospital, you have an excellent facility. But don't expect, if you do need our services, to see everyone here.